I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress isn't finished with Toyota yet. Lawmakers plan to put more Toyota executives in the hot seat next week after the company's CEO, Akio Toyoda, apologized on Wednesday for the way his company handled the sudden acceleration problem in its cars. The intense scrutiny might lead to more power for federal regulators and new mandates for high-tech safety equipment in cars. But a bigger problem for Toyota could come from the 16 class action lawsuits that are in the works, as scores of people are stepping forward with new claims that their cars sped up on their own and out of control. And one of the most dramatic cases is in St. Paul, Minnesota, where a 32-year-old man is hoping for a new trial. Kwafong Lee is currently serving 8 years in prison for vehicular homicide. In 2006, Lee's 96 Toyota Camry shot up an interstate ramp, slammed into an Oldsmobile, and killed three people: Javis Trice Adams, his 10-year-old son, and 6-year-old niece. Suzanne Ziegler is covering the story for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And Suzanne, can you tell us exactly what happened in this accident?
Well, it was an incredibly tragic case. Kwafong Lee was driving home from church with his pregnant wife, his daughter, his brother, and father in the car when he exited the ramp but could not stop. He said he put on the brake and it just didn't work. Well, authorities estimated his car was going 90 miles per hour when it slammed into the back of the vehicle, killing two people right away. Another girl in the car died later from her injuries.
And he said at the time that he tried to slam on the brakes didn't work. But he never actually claimed during his original trial that the car accelerated out of control on its own.
Well, he did say that, you know, he said he stepped on the brake, nothing happened. He swerved to try to avoid other cars, but he just could not stop the car. His lawyer is in the process of trying to track down evidence that would allow a judge to reopen the case. And they're still in that process. And one of the things they want to do is look at the car again, which is still in the city of St. Paul's impound lot. Now, the car is pretty heavily damaged, and I don't know what will come of that, so that's kind of the crux of the case. Will the car be able to provide any evidence one way or another? The city inspector did look at the brakes and did find nothing wrong, but as you know from a lot of these cases with Toyotas, people have said that they stepped on the brake, nothing happened, and then the car computer showed nothing wrong. I think a lot of people I've talked to, at least here in Minnesota, feel frustrated with that.
And Suzanne, has the victim's family agreed, or are they resistant to the idea of getting this case reopened?
Well, as you can imagine, during Kwafong Lee's trial, they were very pointed in their comments to him, very emotional when he was convicted for vehicular homicide. But now, of course, given what has happened, they have agreed with him and are in the process of suing Toyota. That lawsuit has not yet been filed, but the attorney for the Davis family is in the process of compiling that.
Let me ask you briefly, the car that Mr. Lee was driving, it was a 96 Toyota Camry. That's actually not one of the cars that has been recalled for sudden acceleration this time around, but there was a related recall on this model. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Toyota did recall some 96 Camrys for defective cruise controls that could cause sudden acceleration. Whether this car or the testing that they do on it will determine if that was under that recall, we'll have to wait and see.
Now, Mr. Lee himself, he's got four young children and a wife. His children are between 2 and 8 years old. He's still in jail, but do you get a sense that he feels some kind of hope now?
I think he does. I think he's worried about his family, given that he does have so many young children. And I think he's frustrated, and if this is a case where he should be released from prison because of the Toyota recall, I think that everyone in the Twin Cities is anxious to see what happens with that.
Many steps to go and a great deal of uncertainty before that happens, if it ever does. But Suzanne Ziegler, she's business reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to help out.
Well, that case in Minnesota may be a harbinger of things to come for Toyota. Joining us now is Sean Kane. He's founder of Safety Research and Strategies, a Massachusetts-based company that supplies data and research for civil lawsuits. And Sean, this case in Minnesota seems pretty extraordinary, but given all the attention currently on Toyota, do you think we'll be seeing more like it?
You know, it is a pretty extraordinary case, and frankly, you know, the kinds of cases that we're seeing out there, most of the incidents, fortunately, are not resulting in death and injury. Our analysis of the complaints show that about a third of the 2,000-plus complaints are resulting in some type of crash, and again, most of those are not resulting in death and injury. That's the good news. However, there certainly are a number of incidents like the one in Minnesota where it is entirely likely that folks have been prosecuted for causing a crash in which they may not have been at fault.
And Sean, one thing that I understand about these recalls is that from data that you've compiled, there's some more than 2,200 Toyotas and Lexus drivers have submitted some kind of complaint, but only half of those complaints actually involve Toyota models that have been recalled. So there's this whole group of cars out there that people are worried about that haven't yet been recalled.
Yeah, our biggest concern really when we look at this problem is that, you know, there's really two major concerns. First is that approximately half of the complaints that we've evaluated for unintended acceleration in Toyota and Lexus models fall outside of any recall whatsoever. And then the second major concern is that the current recalls don't address a significant number of the complaints that are reported. And the reason why we say that is that reviewing those complaints in detail, we can see that a floor mat or a sticky pedal, a pedal that's slow to return, can't explain the wide open throttle condition that is reported by consumers. And in many cases, there are witnesses, and in some cases, we've even had witnesses by Toyota service personnel that these engines have gone a wide open throttle without anybody depressing, without a floor mat, or without a sticky pedal.
Is this why you say that, you know, the more than 8-9 million cars that have been recalled already is just sort of the tip of the iceberg here, that we're going to see a lot more cars being recalled back to dealerships?
I think at the end of the day, we are going to continue to see recalls emerge over time. And some of the work that we've done working with Dr. David Gilbert at Southern Illinois University, I think he was able to question Toyota's assertion that their electronics are infallible, and if their systems fail, they will always set an error code. What Dr. Gilbert's findings show that are extraordinary is that there are some very simple ways in which the Toyota system does not function that way. In fact, you can lose your fail-safe. You can lose that redundancy in the electronic system, and their computer will never pick it up. And once that car goes into a non-fail-safe mode, it can take any number of possibilities that can introduce problems into the system where the car can go to wide open throttle. It's the first time that actually anybody's questioned Toyota about their electronics and actually found the way they work is not how they describe them. Dr. Gilbert has shown simply through introducing some basic resistance into the electronics of that car at the accelerator pedal, the system can't detect it. And the reason why has to do with their design. Their design is outside of parameters that we're seeing in other manufacturers. The design offers a wide window of opportunity for problems to be introduced wherein the system will never detect an error. Once it's in that state, you basically have a loaded gun. The question is, what happens when it's in that state to get it to pull the trigger? And what Dr. Gilbert has shown is simply, again, introduction of some voltage spikes at very low levels can cause that to happen. You know, what we are saying at this point is we don't know if that is the cause of unintended acceleration in the real world, but it is clearly a bookend. What Dr. Gilbert's findings show us is that you can put the car into a state where this can happen. And it happens in a way that's very much along the lines of the way consumers are describing it. Now what needs to happen is bringing those pieces together to see if they match.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in bringing those pieces together, Sean, I've got to ask you about the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Congress has also said this week that they're going to be looking more closely at NHTSA, maybe allowing it to levy criminal penalties, whereas right now they can only put civil fines on auto companies. And they want to beef up its regulatory power and allow it to maybe even get more up to date with the rapid advances in automotive technology, et cetera. So basically beef up NHTSA. But it seems like this is the exact same organization that fell short in its oversight of Toyota and the automotive industry in the first place. So do you have any confidence that NHTSA as an organization, as an agency, can really take on these expanded powers?
Well, you know, I think when we look back and see where some of the problems came into play, it wasn't a lack of power that left them not asking the right questions or questioning Toyota in the right way. It was simply the way the investigations were handled. The agency was quick to disbelieve consumers. On the other side, they were quick to believe exactly what Toyota told them. What we found is there's a critical time frame in late 2008 2003 and early 2004, at the very time that the agency was investigating Toyota unintended accelerations, where they limited the types of complaints they were going to even examine at Toyota's request. They limited those to only lasting 1 second or less, in which there was nobody's foot on the brake. Now, during that time frame, what's so critical is that we've identified at least 8 fatal crashes in Toyota Camrys alone wherein there was an allegation of unintended acceleration. Those crashes took place over longer than 1 second, and almost everyone indicated they depressed the brakes. So essentially what they did is gut the investigation before it even got off the ground. And that has more to do with the way the investigation was structured and less to do with resource. And, you know, to give you some better meat on that, if we look at what happened in Toyota, when the agency had one single complaint on a Toyota Sienna minivan unintended acceleration that was caused by a trim on the carpet getting caught on the pedal, the agency escalated their investigation and pushed it, and ultimately it resulted in a recall. Now, if we look at other investigations, the agency looked at dozens and dozens and dozens of complaints and claimed they didn't have enough data and they couldn't find anything, closing investigations without really questioning Toyota and really digging into the heart of some of the more complex problems.
And also to put that in another form of perspective, I understand that NHTSA only has roughly $11 million to spend every year on investigations in comparison to, of course, the automotive industry, which has billions of dollars in revenue to use in any way that it deems best. But Sean, let me ask you, moving forward, Congress also suggested this week that maybe they'll take a look at new regulations for what's required in automobiles, possibly putting black boxes in every single car that's sold in the United States. Is that something that's going to help really pinpoint the causes of future problems, you think?
Well, you know, the EDRs, or the event data recorders, are often called black boxes. I think there's an awful lot of emphasis in this discussion around, you know, how they can help us. They can only help when you program in the right information. And we have seen EDR readouts from crashes involving Toyotas, and frankly, they're not very helpful. They don't contain the kind of information. So, you know, it's only as good as what you're capturing. The other problem with the Toyota system is there's no transparency in the way they do this. It's proprietary data that's captured, it's proprietary data that comes out, and you only get what Toyota gives you. So, you know, one of the problems that we've had all along is, the transparency in what's happening. Toyota's been less than transparent about it. Even in the public records, a lot of the public records we rely on, we've had to fight for tooth and nail, and in some cases even had to sue the federal agency to be able to get documents into the public realm.
Well, that's Sean Kane. He's founder of the Massachusetts-based company Safety Research and Strategies. Sean, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything you hear in the program. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. You can also tag us in a tweet. We're Here and Now on Twitter, or call us. The number is 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Just ahead, when the Olympians go home, what headaches will the people of Vancouver be facing? $1 billion of debt for one, and a wrecked city credit rating for another. That's all, back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Well, in the Olympics, Canada did come a step closer to owning the podium last night, with both class and controversy. First, the class. Figure skater Joannie Rochette won bronze last night, a true emotional victory following the sudden death of her mother on Sunday. And the controversy, when the Canadian women's hockey team celebrated their gold medal with beer and cigars on the ice. I'm sure the Molson Brewery was thrilled. The IOC, however, was not. But now, as closing ceremonies approach on Sunday, the host city of Vancouver is looking to life after the Olympics. That's life with a $1 billion debt and a damaged credit rating. Plus, a real estate mess that's left Vancouver holding the tab for the athletes' Olympic Village when that was supposed to be paid for by Wall Street investors. The deal melted down when the stock market did. With us now is Steve Luce of CBC Radio in Vancouver. So, Steve, for Vancouverites, when all is said and done, has hosting the Olympics actually been worth it?
That is a great question, and it would depend on who you speak with in Vancouver. Here's the issue. If you were to have flown into Vancouver a couple of years ago and done a straw poll of the people who supported the Olympics and the people against the Olympics, you would have probably found a pretty vocal minority who didn't want the Olympics to come here at all. We're talking 30%, roughly, I think, is fair to say. And I think for those people, some of the complaints we heard from them, such as, well, it's going to displace the poor. Well, there's been no evidence of that. Well, it's going to cause traffic chaos. There's been little evidence of that. Well, it's just a waste of money. Well, the jury is still out on that. In terms of the Olympic supporters, I think by and large, they're very, very happy with how these Olympics have gone. No doubt there have been glitches, there have been hurdles along the way, there's been tragedy along the way, but it's shaping up to be an Olympic Games that will go down as a success, at least in terms of the athletics that we've witnessed. What remains to be seen is whether or not the cost escalates beyond what government has promised.
Now, on this financing note, I understand that, yes, the jury really is still out in terms of how Vancouver is going to come out of these games financially, and I read that the city may be in as much as $1 billion in debt.
Well, that billion-dollar figure comes from the city having to take responsibility for the Athletes' Village, which is really just a huge condo development on prime Vancouver land. So even the most vocal critics of the city having to be put in this position, and it's really been put in this position through some rather complicated accounting, essentially there's a hedge fund group out of New York that originally was responsible for this. They kind of went belly up, and the city had to step in to ensure the Athletes' Village was built on time and on budget. But the real estate economy here in British Columbia is red hot, so they will recoup a lot, if not all, of the money through selling the condos once the athletes are all gone. But Canadians have a long, long memory when it comes to Olympic spending. 1976 in Montreal, widely considered to be a financial disaster. And most people you talk to will tell you that Montreal just finished paying off the Olympics just a few short years ago. Mind you, the Summer Olympics, a much larger event than the Winter Games. But folks are worried here. I mean, we're just coming out of a recession now, but what we're hearing from government is that they're still planning on getting a balanced budget out of this, and they say that revenues from merchandise sales have exceeded expectations, and advertising and sponsorship revenue has been right on target.
So you mentioned Montreal in 76. Wouldn't a closer comparison be Calgary hosting the Winter Games in 88?
Well, first of all, Calgary is essentially Dallas, Texas, Canada. It's Dallas North, and Vancouver is not. Vancouver is very much a sort of a San Francisco vibe up here. And from a financial perspective, though, the Winter Games have certainly grown in scale. And just take a look at the security costs. You cannot tell me that in Calgary they spent anywhere near to $1 billion on security. And here in Vancouver, that is the number that is being used by the mainstream press. Now, Calgary was seen as a success all the way around, financially, on the field of athletics, with the exception of no gold medal for Canada. Calgary was seen as a huge success. And what Calgary also doesn't have is an element of political dissent that you have here on the West Coast. Much more visible signs of protest in Vancouver that you would see if Calgary were hosting the Olympics this year. But by and large, with the exception of one protest at the Hudson's Bay headquarters, one of the main Olympic sponsors in downtown Vancouver, the protest has been fine. And there's been little complaint about the way police have conducted themselves.
Now, another thing that we here in the United States, of course, watching on TV, have been hearing a lot of is the weather in Vancouver. I understand that, hey, we shouldn't be all that surprised that it's been maybe a little warmer than a Winter Games might expect, because Vancouver has long been known in Canada as the place you go to escape the Canadian winter. So how has the weather really played amongst Vancouverites' opinion of the Olympics?
First of all, I'm glad as a Vancouverite that people finally get a sense of what Vancouver weather is actually like. It's very similar to what you see in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. We don't get a ton of snow. They knew this going in, but they also knew they would have to have some serious contingency plans. And by and large, those contingency plans have worked. But as far as local Vancouverites go, this is what we deal with every year. It's a love-hate relationship with the weather. We love those sunny days in February. And then when the rains really sock in here, Longtime Vancouverites say, well, maybe it's time to move to Toronto.
Well, short of actually moving to Toronto, those folks who do decide to stay in Vancouver, I mean, at the end of the day, after the closing ceremonies wrap up, it's Vancouverites themselves who are left with the aftermath of the Olympics. So do you think that in the long run, the city is going to see hosting the 21st Winter Olympics as, you know, a gold medal around its neck or an albatross?
You are always going to have an element of political dissent here in Vancouver, and you're always going to have an element that will say that this was a poor decision. However, wisely, the politicians behind the Olympic bid very early on said, this is not Vancouver's games. This is Canada's games. They want to capitalize on the national sponsorships that come from companies that have headquarters in places like Toronto and Calgary, and they've been able to do that, selling this as a national event.
And on that note, that's Steve Luce. He's morning reporter for CBC Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
There are now at least 26 suspects in the January 19th killing of Mahmoud Al-Mabou, a top Hamas operative in Dubai. Turns out more and more people in Israel have names and passports matching the suspects, and they claim their identities had been stolen, deepening suspicions that Israel's spy agency Mossad is behind the assassination. Joining us is the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus. And Jonathan, we'll get to the diplomatic debacle this has created in just a moment. But first, investigators in Dubai have an amazing electronic paper trail that convinced them of Mossad's involvement there. I mean, there's the forged passports, credit card receipts, cameras in the hotel where the killing took place. This all vividly captures the movements of the suspects. I mean, it's like watching a spy novel unfold.
Well, it is remarkable, and I think it's an indication both of the fact that the Dubai police authorities have conducted quite an impressive operation so far. What there isn't, of course, is a smoking gun pointing directly at Israel, but there are, if you like, the smouldering scans of the passports and all of the other electronic and video information they've put together, which do suggest that this was a highly organised plot. It was conducted by a professional intelligence agency, and it seems that the perpetrator escape from Dubai without any further repercussions.
But the repercussions now seem to be slowly filtering out of Dubai and across Europe, actually, because among the people living in Israel, Israeli residents who say that their identities were stolen, these are people who are in dual citizenship. There are 12 Britons, as I understand, 6 Irish, 4 French, 3 Australians, and a German. And their respective governments are quite angry that their citizens may have been used as some kind of pawn, or at least have their identity stolen, to pull off this operation. They want answers from Israel, but are they likely to get them?
Well, already Israeli ambassadors have been called in London, in Paris, in Australia. I don't think that they've been able to provide any further information than what we've heard in public from Israeli government spokesmen. There are really two sets of issues here. One is the fraudulent use of passports, and that's the thing that the governments have most immediately condemned and criticised. The other, of course, is this issue of identity theft. That, in some ways, I think, is indeed more serious. I mean, it's potentially possible that some of the Israeli individuals involved could take their government to court over this. But I think the whole affair does underline now the very different environment and climate in which we all live, with many more means to track individuals' movements, their identities, their credit card records, mobile phones, and so on. And that is going to make this kind of operation in the future much more difficult.
Now, in closer examination of Mr. Al-Mahbou, I mean, it seems that there would be reason why he would be under the Israelis' crosshairs. I mean, he was involved in smuggling long-range missiles into Gaza, also wanted by Israeli authorities in the deaths of 2 soldiers who were captured and killed in 1989. But on the other hand, even the Israeli press at home there is saying that this was a tactical success, but potentially a strategic failure because of the diplomatic fallout from it. So do you see that there are possibly long-term consequences for Israel?
In terms of whether it's a tactical success or a strategic failure, look, you can argue it any way you like. Is one individual irreplaceable? Of course, somebody else will come along and perform, I'm sure, the activities that he was performing. Is the downside going to be greater than the immediate benefits of removing him from the scene, as far as the Israelis would have it? It's very difficult to say. I mean, I think in terms of intergovernment activities, I think this sort of thing will pass. I mean, let's be kind of grown up and mature about this. All governments don't necessarily go around assassinating people. They certainly use fake passports. Their intelligence services get up to all sorts of skullduggery. I think there's a wider area, though, where this will be problematic to Israel, and that is in the, if you like, in the court of international public opinion. I mean, rightly or wrongly, Israel is often perceived as a country which sets its own rules, which doesn't abide by international norms and so on. Now, of course, many Israeli spokesmen and their supporters disagree with that violently. But I think amongst those people who are already predisposed to be critical of the Israelis in the wake of the Gaza war and so on and so forth, clearly this kind of event is not going to change their views about the way Israel and its government behaves.
That's Jonathan Marcus. He's BBC's diplomatic correspondent. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a bit. It's Here and Now. The small South African nation of Swaziland has the highest rate of AIDS infection in the world, with over a quarter of the population infected, a rate high enough that the majority of deaths in the country are due to AIDS. Life expectancy has fallen in the last decade from 61 years to 32 years. And the United Nations Development Program writes that if it can't be brought under control, the AIDS epidemic seriously threatens the existence of Swaziland as a country in the longer term. The region has also experienced a series of droughts over the last decade. The Bantwana Initiative, which is part of World Education, a Boston-based nonprofit, has been developing programs with schools in Swaziland to help children who've lost parents to AIDS. Recently, two members of the group stopped by our studio. Mr. Welcome Matabele Mkalipi and Ms. Mavis Vilani work with the Bantwana Initiative. I asked them to describe the students they work with, and first up is Mr. Mkalipi.
These kids I teach, really, you feel sorry for them. Looking at most of them are orphans because of the epidemic, HIV/AIDS. So they lack so many aspects of support, emotional support, economical support, you know, psychosocial support. That makes my job very difficult because some other time you go into a class, somebody is sick. He has got no money to go to clinic. You go to class, somebody is emotionally stressed. You talk, you try to converse. He does not contribute anything. So that makes my job very, very difficult because of these problems associated with these kids. I see them every day and it makes me feel bad.
Food is an issue as well. I mean, do you see children coming hungry sometimes?
Very much so, because my region is the hardest hit by the drought. As a result of that, as some of these kids stay all by themselves and they travel long distances, some travel as long as 15 kilometers to and from school. So they come to school on an empty stomach, and the only meal that they usually enjoy, it is what is offered by the school during lunch hour. It makes my work very, very difficult.
You've mentioned the lack of supports when mothers and fathers are no longer in the lives of these children, and that actually brings me to really one of the most interesting programs that you run. It's just to teach children the things that they would otherwise learn from spending time with their mother and father.
You know, what used to happen in the past is the mother, while carrying out the house chores, would call her daughters and try to share some information that will benefit them in the long run, making them to grow to be responsible and good women. And that was fading off. So now we have somebody coming from the community and acting as a mother, talking to the girls. The father, while doing home chores, he will call all his boys while doing things. He will share information that will benefit them in the long run. Through the program, it has been reintroduced. That's why on a weekly basis, somebody senior from the community comes into the school to actually help groom the boys to be responsible.
Well, Mavis, if I can ask you, so when it comes to HIV and AIDS education, what exactly are you teaching your students?
There is this policy within the Ministry of Health for schools. It doesn't allow teaching about contraceptives like condom use. Actually, you are not allowed to teach about that, which we've been having a challenge because children are really having sex And having sex means you are at more risk of contracting HIV if you are not using any contraceptive measures.
How old are the children, will you say, when you find they're having sex?
Some of them are below 12, so even at primary level you encounter such problems.
So if you can't teach directly about things like contraceptive use, how is it that you're teaching the students on how to stop the spread of HIV?
The only allowed one is the A, which is called the abstinence. And sometimes for me, I find it stresses me because I have the evidence in front of me. It tells me that children are sleeping, but the only thing you have to talk about is abstinence when it's unrealistic because already they are engaging in sexual intercourse.
I have to ask, with infection rates so high, and it doesn't seem as if the AIDS problem is being reduced in any significant way. So are there times when you look around and you start losing hope or you think, why are we doing this when so many more people are going to continue to die and we're at risk of possibly even losing this generation?
Actually, I think for me now, I am becoming more positive. I believe there is hope. We are educating much when it comes to HIV issues. And I must say that even though in Swaziland the children know about HIV, it's around 90%, but the comprehensiveness of that knowledge is quite questionable. So we are trying to hammer on that because there are myths and misconceptions. Some are cultural related about somebody who's HIV positive and the stigma and discrimination that has been associated with it. And really that's what we are trying to break.
And I understand that you may have brought a letter from one of the students at the school. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think, could you read that letter to us?
Actually, there was this particular child who wrote a letter which almost made me cry. And she said something like, we as a vulnerable children are like grass and stones. Everywhere you go, you will find us. War has been declared in our community that every old person must die and we must remain behind alone. We thought we no longer mattered in life, but we now have hope, and we really would like to thank your organization for giving us food, for giving us garden, for helping us cope well with the life that we have been facing in life.
That's Mavis Vilani. She's an evaluation officer for the Bantwana Initiative. Mavis, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Magna. It's been my pleasure.
And also I was joined by Mr. Welcome Matabela Mkalipi. He's a teacher in Swaziland. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Magna.
For more information, go to our website, hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Some artists only need one name, and Yuriko is one of them. She performed with modern dance legend Martha Graham for 23 years. She created a role in the original Appalachian Spring. And she became world famous dancing the role of Eliza, on screen and in the original stage production of The King and I. Yuriko turned 90 this month, and she hasn't slowed down, even though she took a serious fall last year. Born in America, she spent her childhood in Japan, where she started dancing professionally when she was just 10 years old. And at 22, she was back in the U.S. in California at the start of World War II. Yuriko and her family were sent to a U.S. government internment camp in Arizona. But it was there, Yuriko says, that to save her sanity, she talked her way into teaching dance. She then moved to New York and shattered racial barriers there. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon sat down with Yuriko when she visited the Boston Conservatory recently, and she asked Yuriko about why she calls herself a risk-taker.
Well, you have to take the risk in a sense that when something comes your way, you have to judge instinctively whether you're going to take it or you're not going to take it. And I always took it. Took the chance. Maybe this is right. I wasn't sure, but that's risk taker.
The one thing you seem to be sure of is that you knew you wanted to be a dancer from age 10.
Oh, from 6. Yeah.
What was it about dance, do you think?
I don't know, but I think it's moving and the freedom.
When World War II broke out and you were in your early 20s, Japanese Americans were sent to camps, and you were one of them.
Yes, yes.
You very much wanted to be a dancer. You were a dance student when you went to the camp. And you get there, and your whole family is locked up in this huge camp of 10,000 people at Gila River in Arizona. You taught dance there. How did that come about?
I'd been in the camp, I don't know how long, but I was worried about my future career, and it just got to me, and I had a little nervous breakdown. And I was sent to hospital and came out the next day. But making a long story short, I just didn't want to waste my energy not doing anything. And I thought, oh, maybe I know a little bit about dance, so maybe I should open up a studio, dance studio. So I went to the administration and asked for a studio space and pianist. And they gave it to me, and again, there's the risk taker. I just started teaching and gave recital, choreographed, made costumes.
Here you are locked up in a camp, but you take the initiative and make some form of freedom out of it.
I knew that dance was giving me outlet, and dance saved me. If I'm in trouble, emotionally or whatever, the circumstances, I always return to dance. When something sad happens, I would go to the studio and start dancing. It was there that I could forget my troubles.
What are your thoughts looking back on that period in history now?
Well, it was one of the passages that was meant to be for me, because that brought me to New York much sooner, because I wanted to come, but I didn't have the money.
After 18 months in the camp, you were given the permission to go. And you were given a one-way ticket, one suit, and $25 from the government, and you had some money from the dance camp.
I was paid $19 a month, and I saved, so totally I had $100.
And there you are. You arrive in New York. It's 1943.
My supervisor in the camp, she met me at the Grand Central Station. She promised me a seamstress job. I want you to break the union, seamstress union, because they were not hiring Japanese Americans. I said, oh. And so I met the head of the union, and she liked me, and I was sent to one of the exclusive store, alteration shop. There I met many seamstresses, Italian mostly. And I loved them, and they loved me, and they fed me well, too, many things. That's how I ended up as a seamstress.
You were the first Japanese-American or American-Japanese woman to be hired for this job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this time in New York, there were only 2,000 Japanese people, in 1940, that is, just a few years before.
Well, I didn't know all these things, except I was in New York. And here I am, and I'm working. Now it's time for me to look for a dance teacher. I had three names: Doris Humphrey, Hanya Holm, Martha Graham. And the closest was Martha Graham. So I went to her studio.
Describe your first meeting.
She was alone. She invited me in, asked many questions about camp, and she wanted to see how I danced. So I said, I can't do that because I was not in training at all. So she said, come to my class. I said, no, I can't come to your class because I don't know anything about your technique. You see, it's a Japanese way that you don't go to a master right away. She said, everybody comes. I said, I can't. Send me to your student. And Before I left, she said, "Yuriko, I want to tell you, if you are good, you'll be accepted." I mean, that was something. I thanked her, and I walked out of the studio, and tears started to come down my face. I walked home, all the way home, crying.
Within 9 months of arriving in New York, you were a member of the Martha Graham Dance Company. You were in the first production of Appalachian Spring. And it's the story of a young pioneer couple, a preacher, and some followers. And you are the follower that gets picked, I guess, by the preacher.
Yes. Favorite follower. Everybody envied me.
It's a story of freshness and beauty.
And struggle with a career.
How so?
With Martha's own career, she knew she was in love. But there was this conflict, like I had my conflict in camp and breakdown, you see. She was always, she moved from within. So I cherished every moment.